content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Religion News Service. And our first story today, Latino pastors look to retrofit preaching and pastoral care to the trauma of mass deportations. This was written by Aleja Hertzler McCain from Monrovia, California. In a Home Depot parking lot beside a freeway on-ramp in this city, northeast of Los Angeles, a woman sang to a small crowd in Spanish over her band's rocking cumbia rhythm, "How I love my people for being more than brave." Across the interstate ramp, under peach-colored clouds, a collection of tiny crosses memorialized the spot where Carlos Roberto Montoya Valdez, a day laborer who used to come to the Home Depot to find work, was struck and killed by an SUV as he ran from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. The crowd had come 40 days after Montoya's death for a October 10th vigil. Pablo Alvarado, co-executive director of the National Day Laborer Organizing Network, spoke about his childhood memories of the impact of Catholic Archbishop Oscar Romero's role as a moral voice of El Salvador during the country's military dictatorship and civil war. Romero, who was assassinated while celebrating Mass in 1980, became a Catholic saint in 2018. Alvarado told the crowd, "I don't know, but I don't feel that that person exists in this moment in our country. We don't have that strong of a moral voice. And we all know what happened to Bishop Romero. And in the absence of an individual like that, then who has to be that moral voice? But Christian leaders are working to strengthen this kind of moral voice, using Romero as a model. At Life Pacific University in San Dimas, the Association for Hispanic Theological Education was meeting at a preaching and migration conference from October 9 through 11th. Alma Tinoco Ruiz, assistant professor of homiletics and evangelism at Duke Divinity School, urged preachers to draw on Romero's preaching to help their communities navigate trauma. What made Romero such a prophetic and pastoral preacher was his ability to clearly hear the voice of God, both through Scripture and through the people who suffered, and to let both illuminate each other with the light of Christ within them," Tinoco Ruiz said in her Spanish-language keynote. The conference often took up the question of how to best to preach and pastor congregations traumatized by President Donald Trump's mass deportation policy. Tinoco Ruiz called on the 250 attendees to be empathetic witnesses, to speak with tenderness and courage, naming the suffering, but also the promises of God. In one panel, Harold Segura, Director of Faith and Development for World Vision in Latin America, urged preachers to take into account children who are listening to sermons, saying they can interpret teachings in a very literal way. That preaching can end up adding more pain to children's pre-existing trauma, Segura said. He advised pastors to spare children violent theologies that depict a punishing God, as they might not know how to make sense of why they are suffering. Tinoco Ruiz also told her keynote audience that homilies should be instruments of healing, not only for present-day harms, but historical wounds from colonization, slavery, natural disasters, and human conflict that scientific research says may be passed on genetically to following generations. Hidden below the resilience, the wounds remain, and healing continues to be necessary, she said, but the body will pass us the bill. She stressed the importance of not giving false promises of instantaneous change from devotion to Christ, as some preachers do, Healing can take time, and sometimes it requires more than prayer. In a workshop on trauma and immigration, the Reverend Alexia Salvatierra, academic dean of Fuller Theological Seminary's Centro Latino, said acknowledging the trauma of migration is crucial, saying a lot of the time undocumented people feel so much shame that they do not bring their migration situations to prayer networks. We need to give permission in sermons for them to do that, so that they know that there is no shame in breaking an unjust law, Salvatierra said. It is very important to remove the shame and speak about the grace of God. Every person makes mistakes and commits sins. Salvatierra advised churches to give threatened immigrants opportunities to participate in collective action and to take on responsibility. We have to combat the feeling of being without power, without hope, without support. One essential way to combat this is the experience of agency, the experience of being an agent of God. An idea of what this might look like was presented at an October 8th meeting of the Los Angeles chapter of the Latin American Theological Fraternity held at La Fuente Ministries, a bilingual faith community in Pasadena. La Fuente maintains a fund for congregants who have experienced income disruption due to fear of ICE raids, and for application fees for congregants working to adjust their immigration status. Church volunteers are also bringing groceries to people who are too afraid to leave their homes, the pastor said. The church has also worked with the Clergy Community Coalition, a local faith-based organization, to plan family preparedness sessions where families discuss what to do in case of a deportation, and to participate in a rapid response network that addresses ICE activity. Our community, La Fuente Ministries, is navigating the devastating season of fire and of ICE, said the Reverend Marcos Canales, the community's pastor, pointing to three people in the congregation who lost their homes in the Eaton fire. Many others were evacuated or displaced, said Canales. The fire, followed by immigration raids, he told Religion News Service, is a double collective trauma. Canales' wife, Andrea, a clinical psychologist, led the congregation in creating 12 stations of grief in the church, including art projects, a map showing the destruction, candles for community members detained by ICE, and white trees where congregants hung white tags with some of their losses of the year. Canales said that at La Fuente, preaching a theology of migration where God the migrant relates to the migrant people of God is an important part of Sunday morning. In his presentation, Canales, who grew up moving around Latin America with his pastor parents before coming to the U.S. as a student, said migration is part of God's plan. The movement of all of the species and of creation itself reveals that it's a design that responds to the divine law of interdependence and relationality, of communion and liberty, he said. He also said that maintaining critical memory, which comes from a biblical tradition, is an opportunity for repentance and drawing closer to God. It's why he and the Clergy Community Coalition are working together to have a presence at the stream of vigils, like the one for Montoya in the Home Depot parking lot. It's also why he's preaching about Latin American history, including the decades of U.S. intervention into the economies, governments, and militarization of the whole continent. Canales said in his lecture, "The movement of people isn't an accident or a misfortune or a crisis. It's a direct consequence of structural sins rooted in colonialism and extractivism. Forgetting that history creates physical and mental walls and borders," he said. Our second story, an indigenous approach shows how changing the clocks for daylight savings time runs counter to human nature and nature itself. This was written by Rochelle Wilson Tolomar, who's a lecturer in Spanish Environmental Cultural Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And this is a commentary that does not necessarily reflect those views of the Religion News Service. And this is part of a subsection of the news service called The Conversation. It is that time again, time to wonder, why do we turn the clocks forward and backward twice a year? Academics, scientists, politicians, economists, employers, parents, and just about everyone else you will interact with this week are likely debating a wide range of reasons for and against daylight savings time. But the reason is right there in the name. It's an effort to save daylight hours, which some express as an opportunity for people to make more use of time when it's light outside. But as an indigenous person who studies environmental humanities, this sort of effort and the debate about it misses a key ecological perspective. Biologically speaking, it is normal and even critical for nature to do more during the brighter months and do less during the darker ones. Animals go into hibernation, plants into dormancy. Humans are intimately interconnected with, interdependent on, and interrelated to non-human beings, rhythms, and environments. Indigenous knowledges, which, despite their complex, diverse, and plural forms, amazingly cohere in reminding humans that we, too, are a part, an equal part, of nature. Like trees and flowers, we are beings who also need winter to rest and summer to bloom. As far as we humans know, we are the only species that chooses to fight against our biological presets, regularly changing our clocks, miserably dragging ourselves into and out of bed at unnatural hours. The reason, many scholars agree, is that capitalism teaches humans that they are separate from and superior to nature. Like the point on top of a pyramid, that, and I argue, that capitalism wants people to work the same number of hours year-round, no matter the season. This mindset runs counter to the way indigenous people have lived for thousands of years. Indigenous views of the world are not the pyramids or lines of capitalism, but the circles and cycles of life. Concretely, time correlates with terrestrial and celestial changes. Historic records and oral interviews document that in traditional indigenous cultures of the past, human activity was scheduled according to nature's recurring patterns. So, for example, a meeting might have been scheduled not at 4 p.m. on Thursday, but rather at the next full moon. Everyone knew well in advance when that would arise and could plan accordingly. Such an acute sensitivity to nature's calendar has symbolic meaning, too. To look up and see the moon in the sky at night is to see the same moon that someone once saw centuries ago, and someone else will hopefully see centuries into the future. Time is interwoven with nature in a sense that far exceeds Western understanding. It embodies past, present, and future all at once. Time is life. In the 2015 movie Embrace of the Serpent, examines the relationship between indigenous cultures and knowing and of cultures of knowing and colonizing forces. In this indigenous context, daylight savings time is nonsensical, if not outright comical. Time can't be changed any more than a clock's hands can grab the sun and move its position in the sky. The sun will continue to cycle at its gravitational will for generations and economic systems to come. Like time, indigenous approaches to work are also more expansive than the capitalist economies. They indicate and value all life-sustaining activities as work. Taking care of oneself, of the sick, of the elderly, of the young, of the land, or even merely resting, for example, are equally valuable activities. That's because the objective of most indigenous economies is not to increase an economist-invented measurement of production by working from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. Rather, their goal is to find and generate a holistic well-being for all. Daylight savings time is exclusively designed for 9 to 5 workers. It attempts to boost economic activity by giving them and them alone more light. Think about it. Care workers, who are predominantly women, work beyond daylight hours year-round. Where is their temporal accommodation? Though likely not malicious or even purposeful, the political intervention of daylight savings time ignores the massive workforce that operates on the periphery of the mainstream economy. In some ways, it reinforces the discriminatory idea that only some workers are worthy of economic recognition and accommodation. In this sense, daylight savings time raises the question, does the economy really need that extra hour of sunshine and worker productivity? Traditional economic philosophies would likely answer no out of principle. They may see daylight savings time as trespassing the biophysical, ethical, and sacred limits of the world ecology by encouraging cultures of overwork and overconsumption. Since the invention of the clock, capitalism has increasingly treated time as an inanimate object largely independent of the environment. While the rest of nature rises and slumbers to lunar and solar cycles, humans work and sleep to the resetting of their artificial clocks. In their 2016 book, The Slow Professor, humanities scholars Maggie Berg and Barbara K. Sieber connect this objectification of time to an inhumane culture of work. Modern workers, they write, are increasingly expected to treat time as a numerical asset that can be managed, measured, and controlled. Time for rest and relaxation has no countable home in the capitalist economy of life. There are certainly practical benefits to using time to measure and monitor economic activities, such as knowing the precise time a meeting is scheduled to start and end. But Berg's and Sieber's work reveals how that reasonable practicality has been subverted to hold workers captive within what I argue is an unsustainable, unnatural, and exploitative environment. Work time and lifetime have blurred into one. In capitalism, work is expected to grow infinitely, despite existing within a finite world inhabited by limited beings. At a time when human activity depletes the world's ecology rather than sustaining it as it once did, this around-the-clock approach to work is simply incompatible with nature. In sum, daylight savings time reproduces the same destructive logic that has led humans and non-humans into the present socio-ecological crises. Disobeying and dominating the laws, rhythms, and shapes of nature, as seen in the seasonal exploitation of human energy and labor via daylight savings time, perpetuates the unparalleled social and environmental decline uniquely characteristic to the current capitalist era. Unlike the relatively recent inception of capitalism, indigenous wisdom espouses a set of philosophies as old as time. It reminds humans that there are other ways of interacting with time, work, and the environment, ways that existed before capitalism and that can exist afterward, too. In my view, people might be better off if the discussion about changing the clocks in the fall and spring wasn't about how much time we can make use of or how much daylight we might save, but rather about reducing the number of hours we are expected to be made useful and profitable to secure a more just and sustainable existence for all. Our third story. A Nation of Islam heir speaks against war in Gaza. This was written by Fiona Andre for Religion News Service. As Newark Mayor Ross Baraka accepted an award from the Muslim American Ministry for Human Salvation on October 26th. He praised how the Nation of Islam, a black nationalist Islamic movement from which the MAMHS was derived, left a mark on the city. "It is without question that Newark is a Muslim town," Baraka said. "We still feel and understand the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and were with Dean Muhammad at the same time. Elijah Muhammad was an early leader of the Nation of Islam, and Warwith Muhammad, his son, also served as a leader." Nearly 100 supporters attended the ceremony at Newark Central High School, part of MAMHS's 5th annual Muslim American Day of Leadership. Above all, attendees came to hear from Imam Earl Abdulmalik Muhammad, who founded MAMHS in 2019 and considers himself Warwith Muhammad's successor. The Warwith Muhammad Faith and Just Society Humanitarian Award, which was named after W. Dean Muhammad, was given to Baraka in recognition of his decades-long engagement in Newark. In May, the third-term Democratic mayor made headlines after being arrested for trying to visit Delaney Hall, the East Coast's largest U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention facility. The presentation also commemorated the 50th anniversary of Warwith Muhammad's appointment as a Nation of Islam leader in 1975, a position he held until he died in 2008. For MAMHS, which has distanced itself from Nation of Islam's controversial black supremacist discourse, hosting the event offered a chance to celebrate its roots and connections with Muslim African-American traditions while asserting its views on issues from the war in Gaza to the Trump administration's immigration policies. Born out of Detroit in 1930, the Nation of Islam was created by Elijah Muhammad, whose preaching on self-empowerment and black supremacy galvanized hundreds of thousands of African Americans. During its heyday, the organization counted boxing champion Muhammad Ali and civil rights leader Malcolm X in its ranks, both of whom parted ways with the organization after converting to Sunni Islam. After Elijah Muhammad died in 1975, the movement split followers between his son and successor, Warwith Muhammad, and Louis Farrakhan, a Nation of Islam representative. After Warwith Muhammad's death in 2008, Earl Muhammad, his longtime assistant, assumed leadership of the followers and further transformed the branch of the movement. In 2019, he founded the Muslim American Ministry for Human Salvation to centralize efforts. Though they share no formal connection, Earl Muhammad told RNS at the event that the Nation of Islam and MAMHS leadership still communicate. "They send us words of encouragement and acknowledgement. We pray for their good success in those things. But we don't have any formal ties with them," he said. Both organizations have seen their influence decline in recent years. According to a 2019 Pew Research Center study, while black Muslims make up about 5% of all U.S. Muslims, just 2 in every 100 black Muslims surveyed say they currently identify with the Nation of Islam. MAMHS counts supporters in all major cities, but isn't affiliated with local mosques, Earl Muhammad said. Though he celebrates the movement's roots in black nationalism, he said, MAMHS now aims to reach Muslims across ethnic groups. "Black Muslims, that language is awkward," he said. "Islam cherishes human identity. Islam doesn't permit us to categorize ourselves in ways that isolate us from other people," noting that the organization's leadership is African American. The group is also involved in interfaith work. noting partnerships with Muslim organizations worldwide for humanitarian efforts geared toward Myanmar's Rohingya, Kashmiri Muslims, and Palestinians in Gaza, as in the West and the West Bank. "It's not possible for us to live in America and isolate ourselves," Earl Muhammad told Religion News Service. "It's selfish to do that. We have to seek out relationships and build strong bonds between people of the various faiths." In his hour-long speech titled "The Struggle for Moral Destiny, How Does Good Prevail in an Age of Tyranny?" he spoke at length about the war in Gaza being a moral test for religious American leaders. He denounced the indiscriminate killing of innocent people in Gaza and Israel's continued campaign in the West Bank against Palestinians. He also cast doubt on the fragile ceasefire in the region. The leader also spoke about the relevance of the organization's message in regard to the Trump administration's mass deportation agenda and what he sees as the weakening of American democracy. For Farada Abdul Tawa Brown, who was raised in the Nation of Islam tradition, messages of these groups are still relevant today. She attended a Clara Muhammad school, a Nation of Islam network of private Islamic K-12 schools for girls, and said these institutions raised her to be confident and exert agency. Now an educator, Abdul Tawab Brown identifies as Bilalian, a term coined by Warwith Muhammad in reference to a black slave, Bilal ibn Rabah, who embraced Islam after being freed and was a companion of the Prophet Muhammad. The designation calls for black Muslims to embrace their faith and African-American identity. "That shaped my entire identity and how I function as a mother, a wife, and moving in the world as an educator," she said at the event. "I've carried that with me through my whole life because I believe that God was the creator and the architect of my character and my right to be at the table of human brotherhood." We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Religion News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.